We have a fairly easy lab ahead of us.
The synthesis of benzocaine.
The mechanism for this lab you should already be very, very well familiar with, since this is nothing more than a
good old classic Fischer esterification. Our starting material is para-amino benzoic acid. We have ethanol both as a reagent and a solvent, which is very typical for these kinds of esterifications. We're using sulfuric acid as our acid catalyst. And we end up with ethyl para-aminobenzoate. Good morning, Dante.
So the synthesis is very straightforward. We throw everything into a pear-shaped flask, attach a condenser, which I would recommend just using the air condenser. They got away using that just fine in the other section. Don't need to bother with the water condenser. Boiling point of ethanol is 78 degrees at atmospheric pressure. So don't overheat this. You don't want it excessively boiling, but you do want it hot enough that you are getting a reflux. There's no co-solvent this time. I know when we did the Robinson annulation, that's the one that had the toluene, correct? Or was that the previous experiment? It was the Robinson, right? Right. So we're not doing any kind of co-solvent this time. But there's, if you heat it for long enough with such a small quantity of material, the amount of water produced is so small anyways that it could just evaporate out of solution. And we are flooding it with ethanol, so that's going to help drive the reaction forward. After the reaction, or even during the reaction, you may see solids form. So if you end up at some point with a container of nothing but solid, like it's a slush, it's not able to stir really at all, then that means either your temperature's low or you might need to add a little bit more ethanol. Now, either your product is eventually going to be a solid, and it does give you this cautionary note that if it does only stay as a solid, you want to heat it longer, try to get everything in solution. Question? Wait, is it ethanol or methanol? Methanol, I'm sorry. Anybody have that wonderful whiteout? It is ethanol, right? There might be a recrystallization with methanol, but I thought the ethanol. That's not fair. Okay. Well, can I keep this? Because I know I'm going to make a mistake. Of course, now that I keep it, I won't, but we'll see what happens. So, yes, ethanol. Add more ethanol if you do end up with solids while you're doing the reflux. Now, once you're done with the reflux, you're supposed to do a wash, aren't you? With what? You do a water wash? At the end, yeah. Is it just water or is there something else? Sodium carbonate this time, right? Not bicarbonate. Yes. I think that what it is it says after half an hour, if you still have solids, that you're supposed to then heat it for another half hour. I don't think there's two separate refluxes, are there? If they're solid, right? Or is it say to do it anyways? We have a room full of people that should have pre-labs that should say, so everybody else. The question was, is it supposed to be two refluxes, or is there something in there that says, if you still have solids that never dissolved, add more of this and that, and then continue? Which Which actually, I can't think of any practical reason why not just add extra anyways. I mean, in real life, we want to try to minimize the use of reagents, but sulfuric acid's cheap, and for the quantity we're using, no problem. And ethanol is cheap. And by the way, I think I already had told you all this before. I don't think this section I need to worry about, but you do realize that the ethanol is not drinkable, that they do purposely put toxins in it. So there's this term absolute ethanol they were asking about, because, you know, there's absolute vodka and absolute, no, they're two very, very, very different things. Absolute just means it's not an aqueous solution, because a lot of ethanol, okay, back up a bit. Water and ethanol make such a good mix that you can't distill one from the other. You have to go and use some other technique in order to purify ethanol past a certain percentage. So ethanol with water in it is an easier thing to make than absolutely pure ethanol. So absolute means more pure, but they still add the toxin, which it's not just because they want to keep undergraduate and graduate students away from the ethanol. It's for tax reasons. Because if it's not consumable, then you can't tax it as if it's alcohol, and so it's a heck of a lot cheaper. Did we come up?
It's an if.
Okay. But I would say maybe add a little extra acid, add a little extra ethanol, so you don't end up in that situation, so you don't have to reflux it for any longer than necessary. Now, we were talking about that wash. It was a carbonate wash, correct? Sodium carbonate? What do you think that is used for? Neutralize what? The sulfuric acid. But what else? What about unreacted starting material? If somehow the esterification wasn't successful, we easily can remove the starting acid from solution, because once you react it with a base, it becomes water soluble, and you're doing this wash, which means it'll be washed out of solution. It also has the side benefit of only producing water and carbon dioxide once it gets fully neutralized. Why can't we just use something like sodium hydroxide? What's that? Side reaction, which is not really probably that likely at room temperature. But why risk it? The side reaction would be saponification. So why are we using something as a stronger base, though, than maybe just plain old bicarbonate? Well, I would actually need to check pKa's to see if we really need to worry about this or not, but nitrogens are usually basic. We had this in sulfuric acid, so it is possible that you might end up with some protonated nitrogen. However, having said that, as we're going to discover once we get to the amine chapter, the nitrogen in this case is heavily involved with the benzene ring through delocalization, exactly the same way that a lone pair of nitrogen of an amide is heavily conjugated with a carbonyl. So because of that, this is less likely to be protonated than other bases, which means it's not quite as strong as other amine-type bases, which in turn means it shouldn't be that difficult to deprotonate them. But if it were protonated, it would increase the chances that it would be water soluble. So I'm guessing that we're using carbonate instead of bicarbonate just to ensure that we have the deprotonated form, which should be more organic soluble. All right, so you collect your, you finish your reaction, you do the wash, then you collect your crystals. It says to wash it with ice cold water. That's because you want to minimize any loss due to any potential slight solubility of the product. It says to recrystallize. Don't. We've done enough recrystallizations. I'd rather use the lab time to catch up on things like the lab reports that we're, yet again, not getting to today. So in compensation for that, though, to assess how pure our compound is, I would like us, for the first time in a while, to do a melting point. And I know that usually even myself, if I was a student, I'd say, oh, not a melting point. But at least that's not as long an activity as a recrystallization. You'll do a solid IR. We won't keep this product for NMR, so once you do get the IR and your melting point, you can dispose of it. No, you may not try out the benzocaine. I mean, the worst that it is, it's a topical anesthetic, which means it could make your tongue go numb, for example, but consider this. You are barely trained chemists in a non-pharmaceutical environment using non-pharmaceutical grade chemicals, producing a product that you're not making any effort whatsoever really to purify. So would you really want to expose yourself to whatever impurities might happen to be there? If you don't have the sense to, the answer is no. So, but we will discuss the compound in just a moment. But let me make sure there's no lab questions. Yes. Oh, sorry. Does anyone have any questions about the procedure? It's really simple experiment. Well, then let's talk a little bit more about benzocaine, because it's not immediately after the section in the lab text, a description about benzocaine. But if you flip a little bit further in the lab chapter, because that whole chapter is about carboxylic acid derivatives, you'll see a little section where it talks a bit about benzocaine and some of its related compounds, like lidocaine, and yes, the same family we have cocaine. Well, why is it that these are pain-killing compounds? Well, okay, who is fairly good with bio? Who could describe the action of a nerve cell? It's funny, you both volunteer at each other. So you say one word, then you say the next one, back and forth. Here we go. Somebody, tell me about a nerve cell. Okay, what is this action potential? So hopefully everybody knows that nerve cells communicate through electrical signals within the cell, but not between the cells. So can you describe a little bit what's going on there, the action? Okay, generated by ion flow. So what's the general shape of a nerve cell look like? It's got a really long thing. It's got a main part to it that might have a few things that come off of it, these astrocytes, right? See, dendrites, sorry. That's why I'm the chemist, not the biology. But if we wanted to, we could do something kind of like this. It's been a long time since I've had biology, so I have this idea in my head of this, like, network of cells. But let's just pretend that that's close enough. And there's a gap. That's the important thing. And then there's another nerve cell. You all promise you're not going to show this to McCulley or Heyer or anything like that, right? Oh, it's one large that goes to the next large one? Is it? I knew I would need it. No. It's going to be too much. I will use the magic of Photoshop. Yeah.
So you're saying it's supposed to be more like that. Okay. Then, you were talking about action potential. So if we were to zoom in, then we have a series of ion channels, don't we? So describe what happens.
Say it again.
So I can't quote. There we go. Y'all have to please remember there's an air conditioner above here, and even though it doesn't affect you, up here you sound like this. So you use that resonant voice to answer. What happens is ions go one way or the other across a barrier. If you only let ions in one direction, you're separating negative and positive charge, which causes a potential, which causes a signal to be generated, and there's this cascade that occurs all the way down the cell. It's principally sodium ions that do this, although potassium ions are also involved. They're different sized ions, so they generally go through different channels that can control which type of ion is going through. So that's the portion that generates the electrical signal, ions moving through these channels. Well, what benzocaine and these other canes do is they block that channel. So it's not that you don't have pain, it's not that the cells aren't necessarily damaged, it's just it sends that signal or starts to. And it starts that electrical impulse, but it never resets. It's like you're permanently stuck in one position or the other, and therefore there's not this constant generation of a signal. Eventually, though, these compounds can decompose. For example, benzocaine's an ethyl ester. There are deesterases. There are enzymes that specifically can deesterify compounds, and eventually that might cause the compound to disappear. There are also monoamine oxidizers, which some of you might have heard the phrase MAOI before. That's a monoamine oxidized inhibitor that prevents that kind of thing. But you can decompose amine compounds by other types of enzymes. So eventually, the compounds go away, and then that means the sodium channels, you can have the flow again, which means the electrical signal gets generated, which means ouch. So when you go to the dentist, you get the shot, everything's blocked for a while, then slowly as the compound decomposes, then you can tell, oh yeah, here I can feel it coming, which I'm thinking of particularly because I have a dentist appointment today. So that's the part of the cell that benzocaine primarily affects. But there are a whole bunch of other compounds that affect this portion right here. And I'd like to talk briefly about that because we will get to this topic again later in the quarter once we've covered other classes of compounds. Because this gap here, called a synapse, yes, has a couple of parts to it. On one side, you have several what are called receptors. And on the other side, you have something that will release a set of chemicals called neurotransmitters. These neurotransmitters come in all kinds of classes, and there's all kinds of neurotransmitter systems in the body. So, for example, across a lot of the muscular system, there are what are called nicotinamide neurotransmitter sites, which nicotine is one of the activating chemicals of that. Which, since it's all over your body, and since your body uses that as a messenger, that's why nicotine is particularly addictive, because your body gets very, very quickly used to having that extra amount of signaling agent around. Some of these neurotransmitters are agonists, which means they enhance the action of that system. Some of these neurotransmitters are antagonists, which means they mitigate the action of that system. And besides the nicotinamide system, there's opioid system, which is where compounds like morphine and such affect for pain mitigation.
We have the amphetamine sites. That's not the proper name of it, but that's where amphetamines are active. You have the serotonin sites, which is one of the most important ones, that regulates mood and sleep patterns and your daily cycle. There's several other types of receptors that we'll, again, get to a little bit later in the quarter. But just since we were taking the time to talk about nerve cells and sodium channels, wanted to show you this. Because once the nerve's signal gets to the end of the cell, causes the release of these chemicals, which then have to bind to the appropriate receptor site in order for the next signal to be generated and then to be communicated on down the chain. And so an awful lot of chemistry these days involves that little bit of the process right there. Either allowing those chemicals to be prolonged, so that's what an MAOI inhibitor would do, would allow these compounds to stay in the synapse for longer, or you might have other compounds that cause them to be decomposed more quickly. For serotonin, there's one specific, that's called a serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitor. So we'll get into some of that a bit later. But for now, I want you to go ahead and get your refluxes set up. The time you're going to have, though, during your reflux, I don't want to waste, because in lecture, we were working on taking sets of carbonyl compounds and trying to figure out what product was going to be produced. But I'd also said I wanted us to be able to take a product and figure out what kind of reagents might have made it. And that's the practice we're going to do here in lab. So let me describe a little bit the type of problems you're going to get. Because, for example, you'll see a problem that'll say one molecule, and then you have a product. It means what it sounds like, that you have only one molecule that has your carbon sources that somehow you have to add the appropriate reagent to get it to create whatever product is there. You'll have another problem that says two molecules form something, and those two molecules, let me back that up, that means you have to use two molecules somehow to make the product. You'll see one that I'm going to label malonic ester synthesis, which means you have to use the malonic ester synthesis to make that product. There'll be one where I don't say anything. It'll be up to you to figure out how to synthesize that or how many materials would be used to synthesize that. And then, that's the types of problems. So you've got six problems. I'll put them up on the board. We'll work on them about a half hour before lab is over so you can have a target. We'll pause briefly to go over those answers. That won't take too terribly long, so you'll have a little bit of cleanup time afterwards. But you want to try to get more to a wrapping up stopping point before we do the answers, just because you won't have forever afterwards. Any questions? The ones we didn't finish? We're going to do those in lecture. And then the rest of lecture, there's no new material. So we're going to review the topics for the exam. And then I understand that there's a plethora of questions for me. Okay. So we'll use the lecture time today for review. So let's go ahead and get going then. Let's review these reverse synthesis problems. First problem. I had said one molecule somehow turns into this unsaturated bicyclic ketone. Hopefully what you observed is that there is an alpha-beta unsaturated ketone, which is the normal product of an aldol condensation. So then we have to step back and think, well, how do we disconnect this molecule to get at what was there before the aldol condensation? So remember that the carbonyl after an aldol is the carbonyl that made the enolate to start with. That means that the new bond was created at the alpha position relative to that carbonyl. So what we need to do then is to cut the double bond at the alpha-beta position, because at the beta position, that's where the old carbonyl was. So yes, this does mean that the molecule was formed as an intramolecular aldol condensation.
So chopping that bond up, going back to the starting material, it's a little bit strange to write, because we do tend to follow the normal pattern of putting our carbonyl pointing away from the other two bonds. And if we do that, you notice we're going to end up with a carbonyl pointing into the middle of the molecule, which, since this is a three-dimensional structure, I'll just do this all day long. How's that? Since this is a three-dimensional structure, there's nothing wrong with this. But if we wanted to write it slightly more eloquently, then we could move both carbonyls one carbon over. Since ostensibly every carbon on the molecule is identical.
So again, the way that I recognized this was the way I'd said when we first learned this reaction, to look for an alpha-beta unsaturated carbonyl. Questions on the first problem? Okay, then moving on, the second one, you had to have two molecules. And the question was asked, well, if you gave us something like that on the exam and we only came up with one, would you count it? No, that's what the number two means. You have to have two different molecules that make it. Well, and it's the same situation to start with. We have an alpha-beta unsaturated ketone, which means it could have been formed from an aldol, but that would just open the ring up, and it wouldn't allow us to somehow further separate the ring. If you haven't figured out by now, the reason I keep saying ring is because if this was two molecules, then somehow it came together in some kind of ring-forming reaction. That would be the Robinson annulation, which is what? It's two things, a Michael addition and an aldol condensation. So first we're going to take the molecule apart going reverse aldol. Once we get there, then we need to figure out a way, how could we have synthesized that intermediate with a Michael addition?
So, again, we'll point out this is alpha beta unsaturated carbonyl containing compound, which means an aldol. Again, I'll chop the carbon-carbon double bond apart because that's what was formed during the aldol condensation. When I do that, here's what results. Let's count carbons to make sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, plus the methyl group down below, that's 7. So I did do it correctly. So notice at the top, because we had a carbonyl there, that again was the carbonyl that was there as the enolate, which means the alpha position of where that double bond is, that was part of the original compound next to the enolate that formed. Then on the other side of that double bond, that's where the new bond was formed, so that's why I broke open the ring at that point. And wherever the beta position of where the bond was formed to, that again is where the other carbonyl was at. Now I need to do a reverse Michael. Because remember, Michael addition, we could recognize by there being a delta carbonyl compound. Well, if I chose the top, carbonyl to be the one where the enolate was formed, then I could say alpha, beta, gamma. Why, yes,
I do have another carbonyl at the delta position. Then, and here's where it gets a little confusing, from that carbonyl, we backtrack again. We say, okay, there had to have been a double bond at the alpha and beta position from the carbonyl that got attacked. And what that means is the beta and gamma positions relative to the original carbonyl. So I know we got a lot of alphas and betas and carbonyls, but if we just look at the structure, if this was the carbonyl that was the enolate, the alpha position is where the attack occurs. From the other carbonyl, we need a double bond. So that would be the beta and gamma. So you again would cut the bond at the alpha-beta position relative to that first carbonyl.
Which means we would end up with acetone and this unsaturated aldehyde.
Now, I went back and forth in my head yesterday about whether this would be the best way to do it, and I came up with a different answer than what I may now tell you. This might be the better way to do the reaction because, oh gosh, and I confused everybody, I think, by saying this. There is no, well, actually, this one's easy. There is no hydrogen in this compound, so there is only one compound that can make the enolate in this case. Even if I had a hydrogen at this alpha position, did I ask this question just on Tuesday? If I had a triple bond instead of a double bond there, how many of those pi bonds would be in conjugation with the carbonyl? Did I ask you all a question like that? No.
So just for think for a moment, forget the problem we're working on. But if I had a triple bond next to the carbonyl, then how many of the pi bonds in the triple bond would be in conjugation with the carbonyl? I'll try that again. If I had a triple bond right here, how many of the pi bonds of that triple bond would be in conjugation with this carbonyl? Just one. Why? Because the two double the two pi bonds and a triple bond are orthogonal to each other, right? So I said something the other day where we did have a compound like this that was just a double bond that was conjugated, though. It didn't have the methyl group there, and so there was a hydrogen that I pointed at and said, no alpha hydrogen. And then I had all kinds of people afterwards who said, but it's an alpha position. But it's not a regular reactive alpha hydrogen. Why? Because if we have a double bond that's already in conjugation with that carbonyl, any anion you're going to form is going to be perpendicular to it and an angle to it. So just in the same way where you said in a triple bond, only one of the pi bonds can conjugate, same thing here. If we put an anion at the carbon at that alpha position, it's not going to be in conjugation with the carbonyl because the double bond already is. So in this case, we don't even run into that issue. We have a methyl group. It can't make an enolate no matter what. We deprotonate the ketone. It's a squishy base because it's delocalized. We have the squishy substrate, the unsaturated aldehyde. Aldehydes are more reactive than ketones. So that should react, make this intermediate, which continued exposure to base. Yeah, we have two alpha protons now, but realize that if the alpha proton to the aldehyde gets deprotonated, it's going to make a four-membered ring, which is not favorable. But this ketone, if that gets deprotonated, you make a six-membered ring, which gives us the product that we really do end up with. Now, after that whole long, drawn-out story, though, let me come back and tell you, what if the top was not where the enolate originally formed? If the bottom was where the enolate originally formed, I could cut between that alpha and beta bond, or alpha and beta position, and what that would give me is propanol as my aldehyde,
And then this unsaturated ketone as the other molecule, which yesterday my rationalization was this. The aldehyde is more acidic than the ketone. So in between the two of these, you still could more easily deprotonate one than the other. Even though the ketone is less reactive, it's also a squishy substrate. So the enolate that you'd form from an aldehyde still should want to attack the ketone, even if the ketone is the less reactive compound, again, because of that squishiness factor. Now, I don't think your textbook really gets much into this topic of the best strategy. So I won't ask you or expect you to know that one of these routes might be better than the other on an exam. You just need to be able to come up with some reasonable good set of molecules, which either of these I'd accept. So questions on this second problem. Third problem then. Oof. Since we got going late, I better step up the pace a little bit here. Third case, I did not give you how many molecules you needed. But hopefully, you recognize this as a beta-ketoester. Which means Claisen condensation. Now remember that in a Claisen condensation, you have two esters, one of which makes the enolate and attacks the other ester. The ester that gets attacked loses its extra functionality. It has this quote-unquote leaving group that comes off. If we look at this product, we see that we have a ketone, so that's the carbonyl that got attacked, and to get back to the ester it may have come from, we do not include the alpha position between the carbonyls, because that alpha position would have come from the other ester that had made the enolate. So I pull the two back apart again, and in this case, I'm going to get ethyl acetate as one of the original molecules. I'll have some form of butanoate as the ester, but what kind of ester do I need to make it? It also needs to be an ethyl ester. Why? Because if you made the enolate and attacked this butanoate, and it was some other kind of ester, then that alkoxide could be kicked out and come back and attack the first ester. So in other words, you'd be prone to transesterification. In order to avoid that, whatever thing might be kicked out by any of the three of these compounds, this, either of the starting materials or the product, you want to have the same alkoxide around in solution if there's going to be one. And again, that way avoid transesterification. Questions. Okay, moving on to the next one, which was the malonic acid synthesis, malonic ester, I should say. You are supposed to make this unsaturated carboxylic acid. Now, your text does not get into the topic of doing a dye substitution on one of these malonic platforms. I think it only goes over monoalkylation. If that's the case, then all the products that you see in your book are derivatives of acetic acid, because that's what would be left over if malonic acid itself decarboxylated. So here is the acetic acid.
And that means the rest of the molecule
is the R group of the alkyl halide that was attacked in order to make the ester.
Now, a couple of you I know were worrying about how in the world do we get the double bond there? It's easy. Start out with diethylmalonate. Deprotonate it. A good base to use would be sodium ethoxide,
since if it attacks the ester, it just makes the same ester, and it's basic enough to remove the alpha proton. We need a primary alkyl halide,
like allyl bromide.
Why not use allyl bromide? The double bond won't be attacked, because if you made an anion from a double bond, that's the base that's conjugate is got a pKa up in the 30s. Why would such an incredibly strong base form from something that only had a conjugate pKa of under 14? So the double bond will survive that SN2 no problem, and in fact this is a really good SN2 substrate. Remember that allyl substrates make good SN1 and SN2 substrates. Once we've done the alkylation, we then need to decompose the malonic ester, which here we might want to be a little careful about conditions, because if we subjected this to acid and heat and water for an extended period of time, then we might hydrate the double bond in addition to the ester. But again, the double bond won't react with a base, so why not do saponification? After which, then we could use a little acid and then a little heat. Because as the section in your textbook on 3-oxoacids shows you, those kinds of acids are prone to decarboxylation. Just two more problems.
So the next one, we have 2-pentanone, or pentane-2-one, that somehow you're supposed to convert into butanoic acid to lose a carbon. Well, we've only seen really one carbon bond breaking reaction, which would be the haloform reaction. After the haloform reaction, you initially have a carboxylate. So remember that when you do it, if you want the carboxylic acid, you need a follow-up acidification step. Then last, we had, a part aldehyde, part ketone. And again, what we should notice here is this is a delta carbonyl carbonyl. In this case, we would call it a delta oxoaldehyde. So that, again, is the telltale sign of Michael addition.
And so same thing as before. From one carbonyl or the other, we want to break the bond at the alpha-beta position to pull it apart to figure out which one was the enolate and then which was the
unsaturated carbonyl compound. So if I take the alpha and beta the way I've written it and break it apart, I'll end up with ethanal and an unsaturated ketone. Now, before you ask me about cis or trans, hold on for one moment. I could have also done it where I broke at the other alpha-beta position which I wrote the bond in the wrong place. There we go. So we end up with an unsaturated aldehyde and acetone again.
Now, what about cis and trans? In this specific case, it doesn't matter. Because even if we have a stereocenter, which we do right in the middle of the molecule, even if we have a stereocenter, wait, actually, let me back that up. Let's make sure everybody does realize that the methyl group where it is, that's a stereocenter. Because even though on both sides it looks like you got the same thing, because on both sides you have a carbonyl, on the other side of one carbonyl it's just a hydrogen, on the other side of one carbonyl it's just a carbon. So that middle carbon with the methyl group is a stereocenter. But because I didn't show whether it's R or S, we don't care what the double bond's configuration is, because only then would it matter whether you had cis or trans to know which configuration you end up with. And I certainly won't be putting any stereospecific reactions on the exam. So are there any questions on any of the review problems?